Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Dan Aykroyd grew up a good Catholic boy up in Ontario, and after he was determined to be a priest until the age of 17, and after settling on a career path, Dan joined the Second City in 73, worked for Second City in Toronto, and then moved to Second City in Chicago. Saturday Night Live made its debut in 75 and included Dan as one of the not ready for prime time players. Dan has been a Conehead, a Blues Brother, and of course a Ghostbuster, and he's currently appearing in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the fifth film in the series that helped launch him as a co-writer and co-star of the 1984 original, celebrating 40 years. Dan is an Oscar-nominated actor, comedian, screenwriter, director, musician, and entrepreneur. He co-founded the House of Blues concert venue and Crystal Head Vodka. And to talk about it all, Dan is joining us once again. Dan, how are you, my friend?
Oh, very good. I think you should travel with me and be my barker, for God's sake.
I can do that.
You know, we did all those things, but I say we, because you don't do it alone. I had so many great collaborators, and my whole value right now is gratitude. That's what I'm operating on, gratitude. Thankful for the people that I worked with, the collaborators that helped me build all of the creative enterprises and business enterprises that I became involved in. I just had some great people who were smarter than me, people who were skilled in so many ways, and to them, I say thank you for where I am today.
That's great. That's a great feeling to have. Absolutely. And you decided to put those proton packs back on for another Ghostbusters. So I know they were probably a lot easier in your 30s and your 70s. I got to figure there's a lot of weight with those things.
Well, they have two sets. They have a rubber one for doing falls and for, you know, stunts and that. And then they have the full 150-pound with the batteries for the lights and the noises. And that is a bit, you know, Billy and I roll our eyes when we put those on. But it's well worth it. This new cast is spectacular. You know, the movie's chock full of sparkly cameos and guest shots. James Acaster, the great English comedian, Patton Oswalt, Kumail Nanjiani, who's a magnificent Pakistani-American comedian. He's so great in it. And there is one scene that's worth the price of admission alone. I mean, it's apart from the fact that it's really an entertaining movie and it's a lot of fun, is there's a scene where the villain, he has to find his horns. You know, he's got these big horns. Mm-hmm. And he goes into an apartment in Queens and he goes and he plucks them off the wall and plugs them back into his head. It is so scary and so funny at the same time. That scene is worth the price of admission.
It's a great movie.
So yeah, you know, I it's fun. It's really, really fun. And the young cast is taking up the torch for the next generation, and they're doing such a good job. I'm so grateful to them for wanting to be involved. Of course, many of them, when they were kids, watched Ghostbusters, and for them to be Ghostbusters, the dream come true. That's for, you know, Mechanic Race and Finn Wolfhard and
Paul Rudd
and Logan Kim.
Yeah,
Paul Rudd was a fan early too as well. Yeah, he's sensational. What a gentleman. He's one of those people that you just go, you know, the greats are great. You know,
very much.
The greats are really great. The ones who are truly great are great. He's something else. Yeah.
Well, isn't it wild? Like 40 years later, did you ever think you'd still be donning the uniform and going out and doing this? I mean, it was such a big hit so long ago, and he never had the foresight of, yeah, we'll revisit this 4 decades down the road. It's amazing.
It truly is, and I'd have to thank Jason Reitman, Ivan's son, and his partner, Gil Kenan, for coming up with the idea for Afterlife. You know, we did the first movie, we did the second movie, which was an acceptable sequel. There's a lot of great stuff in that, The River of Slime and all of that. Harold and I tried to work on a third one, but, you know, people got busy. Ivan had his own career, Billy. We just didn't get around to doing a third one. And then Paul Feig came along with the idea to do it the all-ladies version, which I quite liked. I was a little mad at him because it cost more than maybe it should have, but maybe I should have been watching the numbers as a producer a little better. But that movie, to me, was enjoyable because of the performances of the ladies in there. Obviously, you know, we endorsed it. Jimmy, Billy and I were both in it, and Ernie was in it. So we kind of signed off on it. You know, they departed from the original, and they kind of operated on the fiction that this was the first time that the Ghostbusters existed as with women there. But I loved the villain in it. I loved a lot of the sequences, and I've got to say that the ladies in it were great. I mean, they're so talented. So my only bad rap on it was cost, and again, that I put that on myself, that I should have watched a little better. And that revived interest at the studio in it, and then Jason came up with the idea for Afterlife, which was set in Oklahoma, and then now we're in New York with the Frozen Empire story. And, you know, our hope is that maybe we can do more, not necessarily with the original Ghostbusters, but with the new Torchbearers, have them go on and carry the stories into the future.
It's interesting that you think of it from a business perspective, because that's really, I mean, actor, writer, producer, but you know, you're an entrepreneur at heart, and that is in your soul as well. And I love that you look at these things really even from a business perspective, right?
Well, it is show business. You know, the show is fun, the show is great, but it is a business, and it has to turn a dollar for the producers and for the sponsors and for the people who fund it. So, you know, when we're acting on set and when we're doing our scenes and when we're playing with other actors, we're not thinking about the business. But then, you know, that production meeting in the evening can bring up some sobering details, and you have to deal with it. Luckily, again, we've got great staff and you know, great collaborators to handle that, people who know what they're doing with numbers better than I do.
All right, we're talking to comedy icon Dan Aykroyd, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. Your family's fascination with ghosts dates back to your great-grandfather, who was a spiritualist, and he held seances.
He did, in the old farmhouse, that's right, he did. And he was a member of the Lilydale community up near Chautauqua, New York, and you can go there. Usually in the summer, they have psychic mediums who can trans-channel and reach people that have gone before you in your life and come back with facts and details that only they and you would know. Each medium is registered. They have a registered number. It's a society, a closed society. But it's very credible when you go there and you have a medium touch someone who's gone before, who kind of elbows their way through to get a message to you and with things that you would not know. Mm-hmm. You know, like my dad went there, and I took him. And the medium had all kinds of details about where he used to live in Toronto, the fact that he had a cat named Bob. Wow. I never knew he had a cat named Bob, but he hadn't thought about it since he was a teenager. So, you know, trans-channel mediumship is very valid. If you remember, John Edwards was a psychic medium trans-channeler who worked on CBS for a while. He had a show. He was very talented. And you get, you know, these people who can know how to punch through to the other side. I certainly have, you know, had much anecdotal evidence to convince me that there's a reality there that that can't be disputed.
Well, this farmhouse too was such a centerpiece of your life, and it's where you originated the idea for Ghostbusters to begin with, in reading some of your father's research journals.
That's it. Yeah, the research journals and the diaries. Fate magazine, the American Society for Psychical Research journals, these were the periodicals that were sitting around the farmhouse, which we used as a cottage by the lake for many years. And, you know, other cottages on the lake would have Life magazine or Look magazine or National Geographic. Well, it was all psychic research journals over there at the farmhouse. And to this day, I have guests that stay there, and things happen. There are footsteps, there are bangs and noises, whispers, voices. So it's my dad, he died at 98 there a few years ago. He said that he believed there was definitely some kind of a portal there to the next dimension or dimensions beyond. And I stay over there in the farmhouse alone sometimes, and family members stay there, and my daughters stay there. But I don't have any experiences myself, because it doesn't bother the family. But it bothers.
Interesting. Okay.
It disturbs guests and kind of manifests to guests, you know. And I've frequently had guests come to me and tell me that they've experienced things, and some don't want to stay there again.
Wow. Well, here's what's when I saw you doing this History Channel show, this Unbelievable with Dan Aykroyd, which just ended its first season earlier this year, I thought, man, this is right up your alley.
Oh yeah, that's a great show, because you know the History Channel researchers are meticulous. Mm-hmm. So not only do we have my narration and commentary on the subject matter of these wonderful events that that defy imagination, defy credibility, but you've got the research to back it up, to establish the reality of these events. So I'm working with a great quality team there, and we hope to do another season soon.
That's great. That's great. You know what? I know that comedy and acting weren't really a part of your early life or thinking about doing that. You were looking into criminology and sociology in school, which makes sense, by the way. It ties into really your deep interest into all this stuff. So what changed for you in your late teens to say, you know what? I like performing. I like to go on stage. I like to write. I'd like to do some comedy. What was it for you?
Well, I was studying criminology. I was expecting maybe to work in the corrections service. I did a summer as a clerk 5 with the Canadian Penitentiary Service, writing a manual for prison guards, and that was very interesting to me. You know, that whole area of sociology and criminology. It helped me when I wrote the Blues Brothers, because they're two recidivist individuals, and their profiles, you know, had come across my desk kind of in similar profiles when I was studying criminology. But I had a friend named Valerie Bromfield, who I met in high school, and basically we started to do improv together. We did a cable TV show together with robot cameras, 3 cameras, 1 operator, and Valerie and I doing comedy. And she basically said, you're not going to be a prison guard. You're coming to Toronto. We're going into comedy. And we met Lorne Michaels in the summer of 69, and we did a special with him, and they're sort of the rest of it's kind of all fell into place because of knowing Lauren from that time. So it was really Valerie who pulled me out of school, because I did leave Carleton. I left college and went into acting and radio announcing and narrating and writing and full time while driving a mail truck, you know, to kind of keep me alive.
Of course, of course.
I was a Royal Mail courier.
Of course, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, then I worked for the Queen. I was a Royal Mail courier, so
wow.
I worked for the Queen. Directly.
Okay, of course you did. Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, then you were talking to me off air a little bit about, you know, Second City. You did a flip here with the folks in Chicago from Canada. You know, it's also a place where you met Belushi and Harold Ramis. But this is the 50th anniversary of you touching base down here in Chicago.
Yes, and it was a memorable summer, 1974. The summer Nixon resigned, as I said to you, when that night when we read the newspaper, I went on stage and I did Nixon. Now that I've got some time on my hands, I'm back in San Clemente, and I encourage you to come to San Clemente Dodge Chrysler. I can put you behind the wheel of a Dodge Diplomat today, and I will give you that personal test drive myself. So that was some immediate political satire we were able to do. And, of course, we were under the direction of the great Joe Flaherty, who we just lost.
Yes.
Joe was a massive, massive influence for us. It was Joe and Del Close and Brian Murray, Bill's brother, who were our teachers. And Joe taught us technique. He taught us forms. He was such a great impressionist himself and such a great talent and a sweet, sweet man. All of this generation of Second City, I came from Candy, Gilda, myself, Gene Levy, Martin Short, were all influenced by Joe, because he was our main instructor.
Amazing. Yeah, big loss these last couple of weeks. And then you pivoted to SNL. I mean, you were originally hired as a writer and then on stage, but next year it's going to be 50, if you can believe that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Well, it's an institution now, and thank God it's there. Mm-hmm. I watched the Kristen Wiig show the other night, and wow, boy, I mean,
yes.
You know,
great.
She's a genius, Yeah, it was great. And the writing's really strong. The music was great on that particular show. You know, it's really the only place where immediate satire can be done and commentary on what's going on in the world. It's the biggest late night show anywhere across all time zones. You know, and it should be. And Lauren's sensibility, of course, keeps it going. And I don't see him leaving.
No.
I think it's going to go on until they wheel him out.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What did you think those first few days on the show, you know, writing and on stage? Did you feel like in the very beginning, well, yeah, we can maybe last the season? Did you know how that was going to go? Because it was so different at that time.
Well, Lauren wisely said, you know, I'm not going to do a pilot. You've got to give me seven of them. So he agreed to give them seven. That first night of the show, NBC, the executives there, were looking at the rehearsals. They were looking at the talent. They were seeing performances. And they were ready, in case it sort of all went wrong and it didn't look right, they were ready to push the button and just run a Johnny Carson rerun that Saturday night, yeah, that first
good
night.
Lord.
And that is part of the story that will be told in Jason Reitman's movie, SNL 1975, just how the executives had reserve about it and weren't sure it was going to work. And that's a fascinating part of his story. Other than that, I don't know much about what he's going to be doing, but I do know that that's one of the aspects that's treated in it. They hired me as a writer, but then the first show I performed, you know, and then didn't get paid as a performer until the next year. But I went on stage in the home security sketch and with Garrett Morris, and that was my first. And I remember standing under the audience there where they sit in the scaffolding there, and I'm just ready to go on stage. And I was thinking to myself, well, the next 2 minutes are going to be pivotal in my life. If it works, it'll work, and it's going to be great. If it doesn't, well, you know, I've got my eye on that nice snow plow up at the farm, yeah. And I can get that plow going and make some money in the winter because we have blizzards all the time. So I was ready to put a snowplow fleet together rather than continue acting. But then that turned out that I got laughs. Everyone got laughs. The show was a hit. And then I have this great history of career to look back on thanks to all those wonderful people I worked with. Very grateful, as they say.
Yeah, and you moved back to Chicago or came back to Chicago for the Blues Brothers. And I was looking, John would have been 75 this year, been gone 42 years, which is astonishing. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think today, I think John would have been working in theater in New York. He'd be directing. He'd be probably doing plays on Broadway. He'd be producing stuff. He loved live theater. He was very literate, very well read, and he loved classic actors. And so I think that's probably what he'd be doing today, you know? He would have been a Ghostbuster, of course.
I would think so.
Yeah.
I would think so.
He would have made a great Ghostbuster. That uniform would have looked spectacular on him.
I think you're right. I absolutely think you're right.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking to comedy icon Dan Aykroyd, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. So business has been such a big part of your life and creating new things and things that have had long lasting tenures. So this Crystal Head Vodka, and we've talked about this before, you wanted to bring something to the market that was additive free. When you think about that, you know, a lot of what we do consume in food, drinks, beverages, everything else has so much garbage in it. And this is a really clean and rare vodka where, you know, it is fully additive free.
Yeah, I don't know that any other, I don't mention any other products, but I'm pretty sure we're the only one that has no glycerin, no sugar, no limonene. And I just did it because I would open other products and I would open them up and they'd either smell like perfume or they would smell like nothing. And mine smells like good, clean ethyl alcohol. It's got a nice, clean alcohol smell to it. It makes a wonderful martini. You know, doctors today are saying, you know, we shouldn't have any alcohol at all.
Right.
That we've had all alcohol is bad. Well, that's kind of hard on a guy like me. I mean, you know, I say everything in moderation. And my argument now is, okay, well, if you're going to drink something, vodka is a good, clean alternative. My vodka is a good, clean alternative. Drink something clean. And the best way to drink it, to taste its wonderful qualities, is just to shake it with ice chips, a rinse of white vermouth up in a martini glass, 2.5 ounces of the head. Pour it out of the shaker with ice chips in it sitting at the top like a frozen lake, and then sip that. We have a beautiful sweet vanilla dry crisp note on the corn that we make, and then the anise and peppercorn on the wheat, and then a long beautiful finish on the agave. We make an agave vodka, never been done before. Agave is what tequila is made out of. We have a black skull that it comes in, and that has a lovely flavor as well. Bartenders love Crystal Head because it's the blank canvas into which to pour all of the mixes that they're using. So it's the virgin slate for making great cocktails. And, you know, we're almost 18 years in the business. We're in 80 countries around the world, millions of bottles sold. And it's exciting to see the response of people that want to step up and have something better. It's a little more expensive, $1.32 more than the shot of a normal kind of premium vodka, but I think it's worth it. It's an affordable luxury.
But here's the thing, too. Packaging is so incredibly important, and it really, I mean, it stands out. So I have an old school Chicago bar in my basement, and I have that on my shelf, and it's always very curious when they're looking for a vodka drink. What's that? You know, if they didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And there's a great story behind it. I know these skull-shaped bottles, you know, there's a reason for why you make them this way. They're a symbol of life, reflecting power and enlightenment, you say.
Well, that's certainly what, you know, the indigenous groups that had them in legend, the Aztec, the Navajo, the Mayans, the Zuni, the Anasazi, were all supposed to have had these crystal skulls for scrying, for looking into the future, for positivizing the tribe's experience. And we just wanted a vessel that could sell our idea of purity. And so you'll notice our skull is not scowling. It's a happy, grinning skull.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so beautiful and, you know, just so beautiful. We couldn't put a polluted substance in there. And so that's part of why we brought it on as packaging, because it sold the idea of no additives. And people, if you get on our website, worldwide web, crystalhead.vodka.com, you'll see the thousands of artists around the world who've done things with
it.
Rhinestones, metal plating. I've got one head that's zipped up in leather for you S&M mm-hmm. pals out there. And it's a great package for artists. And nobody throws the bottles away. They, you know, I've got a barn full in Canada from the party that we've had. Yeah, I've got 200 of them sitting there.
I love that.
All empty, sitting there.
Well, you can see Dan in Ghostbusters, Frozen, Empire, and for more on Crystal Head Vodka, simply go to crystalheadvodka.com. Dan, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Always, always great stories. You're just such a joy. And be well and enjoy your time in Chicago and as you promote this great movie and this vodka brand as well.
Well, thanks for your help today. Yes, as I say, we don't do it alone, and you're certainly helping get the word out there on two great quality products I'm involved with, the Ghostbusters movie and the vodka. It's there for you. You can get it pretty well everywhere in stores. Kenwood Liquors out there, Mikey Dixon's great company out there. They have it. They've always been great friends. Binny's has been a great friend to us.
Sure.
Kroger's, I think, is bringing it in, and there's bars around you. House of Blues, another institution I've been involved with, they have it on all the bars there. So just ask for that Crystal Head Bar Car Martini, and you'll see that I know what I'm talking about.
That sounds great. Thanks again, Dan. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dave.